homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There is a Dutch scientist, his name is Frans de Waal. And his specialty is studying animal behavior, specifically primates and apes. He wrote an article for the New York Times maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And in it, he talks about, observing chimps tickling each other, just the same way that people do. And the chimp being tickled was obviously laughing and having fun with it. But he said if he was writing this up in a scientific paper, he would not be able to call it laughter, because in the science world, it's kind of a no-no to anthropomorphize animal behavior. So he said he would have to call it something like vocalized panting. He goes on to talk about the term anthropomorphism and says that it was first coined by the ancient Greek philosopher Xenophanes. And his proscription was in regards to attributing human characteristics to gods. And he said nowadays this term has a broader meaning, and it is typically used to censure the attribution of human-like traits to other species. And he said, as an example, we can't say that animals have sex. They engage in breeding behavior. And they don't have friends, but they have favorite affiliation partners. And he says, we apply these prohibitions, language prohibitions, even more strictly when it comes to the idea of cognition. So I looked up, what does cognition mean? And the Oxford Dictionary defines it as the mental act of acquiring knowledge and understanding through thought, experience, and the senses. And he said, in the scientific community, it is not accepted to say that animals can have cognition, that they can reason things out or think things out for themselves. And he tells the case of a scientist named Kohler, who I think back in the early 1900s was observing chimps and did some experiments with them, and saw that he put a banana on a piece of wood and had a little loop in it of wire. And he had a stick. The chimp had a stick with a piece of wire on the end of it. And he tried to get the banana, but he couldn't. And he tried and tried for a while and then realized he wasn't going to get anywhere. So the chimp seemed to sit there and think about it for a while, and then curved the piece of wire on his stick to make a hook, and then was able to hook it on to the loop on the piece of wood and therefore get his banana. And apparently this person who's writing the article said that even today this Kohler guy is kind of looked down upon, because he postulated that the chimp thought it out, thought the problem through and came up with a solution. He traces this whole mindset back to another Greek philosopher, Aristotle, who put all of human experience, or all of everything in the universe, on what he called a scala natura. And at the top of that was the gods, and then descending down from there like a ladder was angels, humans, or angels, heavenly beings, humans. Below humans was animals, or mammals, dolphins, reptiles, birds, fish, insects, all the way down to snails and clams, and underneath that was plants, and underneath that was minerals and inanimate matter. And, you know, that is I think it's probably a useful way of, or one way of looking at the world. And this Franz de Waal in his article goes on to say, but think, how likely is it that the immense richness of nature fits on a single dimension? Isn't it more likely that each animal has its own cognition, adapted to its own senses and natural history? It makes no sense to compare our cognition with one that is distributed over 8 independently moving arms, each with its own neural supply. Talking about octopi. The article, in my view, boils down to this idea of that humans are superior to all other living creatures. It's a sort of an arrogant attitude that we are superior to all other animals. And Franz de Waal goes on to say, instead of insisting on our superiority, quote, instead of insisting on our superiority in every regard, let's take pride in the connections, unquote. I thought it was a very interesting article, and he's made a bit of a name for himself in bridging the gap between animals and humans and helping humans understand that. In Buddhist cosmology, I think if we're going to talk about animals, it's helpful to look at the the teaching of the six worlds or the six realms. In Mahayana, we say there are six realms, worlds, spheres of existence, planes of existence. In the Theravadin tradition, they say there are 31, and that's just because they divide up many of the ones that we have into subsections, which is Theravadins are very like to do that. They like to study things in great detail. So within these six worlds, these are worlds that beings inhabit. They can also be seen as psychological states that humans kind of inhabit throughout their lifetime. And there are six of them, and there are three unhappy and three happy realms. The unhappy realms are hells, hungry ghosts, and animals. These are the unfortunate, or the places where it is difficult to exist. The hells, the denizens of hells are people who, I don't want to go spend too much time talking about the six worlds in this talk, because it's something that could be, one could spend a week talking about. In the happy realms are the realms of the humans, the heavens or heavenly beings, and asuras, which are considered a type of heavenly being that whose main attribute is competition. The animal realm is the only realm that humans can generally see. Some people have had glimpses of the other realms, but that's very unusual to be able to do, because especially in the heavens, it's said that the forms of these beings are so subtle that they aren't available to our perception. It's also important to understand that none of these realms are permanent. If you do a lot of good deeds in your life, you may find yourself in a heaven, but you won't stay there. And the Buddha taught that the human realm was the most beneficial for understanding the Dharma and realizing enlightenment, because it's not all bad and it's not all good. There's a mixture of joy and pain in the existence of humans. The animal realm is more dominated by instinct and what we call the animal attributes of fear and aggression. And the Buddha taught that it was actually a very difficult place for a being to understand or to realize any kind of wisdom. It's not impossible, but it's not easy. Having said that, I think I want to quote Narada Thera, who said, "The Buddha did not attempt to expound any cosmological theory. His teaching is not dependent on the existence or non-existence of these realms or planes of existence. No one is bound to believe anything if it does not appeal to their reason. Nor is it proper to reject anything just because it cannot be conceived by one's limited knowledge," unquote. So when I talk about these realms, you can take it or leave it. This is the Buddha's teachings. This is how the Buddha saw things. And this is what he imparted to others. You aren't required to believe it or swallow it all in order to train and in order to be a Buddhist. The point in talking about this is that all of these realms, especially because I'm talking more about animals today, these are beings who still have Buddha nature, who are deserving of respect and compassion. It's said that in the Tibetan tradition, they teach that all animals were once our parents, and we should treat them with that kind of respect and love. I know of one person who recognized a relative in one of their pets. Now, there's no way of proving that, but this is what this person felt very strongly. So one of the questions that people have asked over the last while is, what about animals, especially pets, but other animals too, and animals and death? And if you have a pet, or if you're thinking of getting a pet, I think it's really important to remember that you're taking on a real serious responsibility. And one shouldn't just get a pet because it seems like a good idea and not think it through and not be willing to take the responsibility seriously and do what needs to be done. Reverend Master Jiu said that if you have a pet or a animal companion, that you're actually acting as that being's Buddha in this lifetime. Because many people ask about euthanasia, you know, putting their pets down when they get old and ill. It's a very common thing to do. And people say that the motivation is because they feel for the pet and they want to help the pet or the animal. They don't want to see the animal suffering. And often that is the case. They don't want to see the animal suffering. There is the very first precept is do not kill. Zigar Khonchol Rinpoche says, for Buddhists, euthanasia of a pet is not permissible unless one has 100% pure motivation and can accurately see the circumstances of this life and the next life very clearly. Ordinarily, people are not able to do that. Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche sat for hours on the side of a road after their car hit a small animal, just nursing this animal until it died. And his driver he offered to kill the animal and because he was afraid they were going to miss their flight. And he said, no, this is my responsibility now. And he sat there for hours until the animal died. Animals generally die very well. Reverend Master Jiu said animals possess something what she called single enlightenment. In other words, they encounter their reality and their existence without if I could put it this way, without any filters. So they just live their lives. And when it comes time to die, they let go of their lives. Often people, I hate to say this, but often people put down their pets because it's inconvenient, because it means a lot of work looking after them at the end of their life. And they have busy lives and they feel they can't devote the time and the energy. But having had animals that died naturally, I've seen that they let go of their lives very cleanly. They don't leave anything behind. And they go on to the next, they go through the door of death without regrets. Generally speaking, apparently I've been told that sometimes if an animal has some really heavy karma or has been treated really, really badly, that they could there could be something left over. So you don't have to worry about, if you have an animal that is dying, you don't have to worry about doing something wrong. The best thing you can do is you can talk to the pet. You can tell it that you love it and make it as comfortable as possible. If the animal is in pain, you can get palliative drugs from the vet that can help them. If you aren't able to do that, then there are many things you can do to help an animal. But the most important thing is to offer it your love and your gratitude, and to let go of the animal, because the animal is letting go of life. Ultimately, it is one's own decision if one decides to have their pet's death assisted by a vet. But and karmic consequences will flow from that decision, because karma is inevitable and inexorable, and there's no way of getting out of that. Our cat Sima died a few years ago, and I was very, very, I loved that cat very, very much, and I had a karmic connection to it, to her. And I felt really, really honored to be with her when she took her last breath and let go. There was something quite profound about it. And it never even occurred to us to, to have her put down. And I'm really grateful that I was part of that experience. The other thing I wanted to talk about, which is something that arises for Buddhists, is the question of, should we eat animals? Vegetarianism. And there are millions of Buddhists in this world who are not vegetarian, including many, many monks, especially in the Theravadan tradition in the countries such as Thailand, Burma, etc. Because especially in that tradition, those monks are dependent completely on what food is offered by the laity. If the laity is eating meat and they put meat in their begging bowls when they go out on their begging rounds every morning, then they eat it. The only caveat to that is a monk cannot accept meat if the animal has been specifically killed for the monk. They aren't allowed to accept that. The Mahayana ideal is that it is best to abstain from eating animals. And many, many Mahayana Buddhists are vegetarian, but many of them aren't. And there's various reasons for this. For some people, I know a few people, it would just cause so much domestic unrest at home that they aren't really able to eat meat. So they do the best they can. In China, a lot of Buddhists pick one day of the week where they only eat vegetarian food. You know, people could call that duplicitous or, what's that word, hypocritical. But I think it kind of goes along with the whole teaching of doing the best you can. There is a saying, it is not good to eat meat, but it is even worse to look down on those who do. Being a vegetarian does not make a person more holy or enlightened. For instance, Adolf Hitler became a vegetarian when he was long before he rose to power in Germany and was a vegetarian for the rest of his life. So that isn't what makes a person holy or enlightened. In my case, when I started to meditate, I did feel this rising up of empathy for other beings. And at a certain point, I just felt that it was best not to eat them. As George Bernard Shaw, who was also a vegetarian, said, when he was asked, why are you a vegetarian? And he said, well, animals are my friends, and I don't eat my friends. And I didn't think it through that cleverly or anything, but it just came to a point where I decided it was something I didn't want to do anymore. You know, I know a few farmers, and there's one particular person I know who told me once that they compassionately slaughter their animals. They do it with great compassion, and the animals don't feel any fear. And I didn't say anything to the person. I wish I had of now, but the person might have thought that my silence indicated I agreed with them. Killing is not an act of compassion. And animals will feel fear if they're being killed, especially if it's by someone who's looking after them. I have observed in this particular person that there is a certain, I don't want to judge, but there tends to be a certain callousness in their attitude towards the animals. And I've come to the conclusion it's because they see the animals, ultimately, they see the animals as a commodity, not as a being. Not as a being living a life. I remember once Reverend Master was talking to somebody who asked him about some scientists were killing some caribou up in the Arctic in order to do a study for them. And this person said to Reverend Master that this was an act of compassion because it was going to save, or it would be helping to save the whole species. And it was an act of compassion for the species. And I remember Reverend Master's answer, which I felt really profound, is you do not have compassion for a species. You have compassion for another being. That's what compassion is. So I would like to end with two little stories. One was something that I heard read out loud from an article in an outdoor magazine many, many years ago. There was a man who was on the Iditarod sled race up in Alaska, which is a really intense multi-day race where these people are really competitive. And they take their dog sleds and they go over, I don't know how many miles, I think 500 miles. But they also look out for each other. And this guy was mushing along in the snow, and he saw the tracks of another sled that had gone off the trail and into the bush. And so he was worried that something was wrong, so he followed the trail. And he came across the sledder, who was lying prone in the snow on a crest of a hill looking down on a lake. And the guy said, "Quiet, get down." And so he got down and he watched, and over on the lake there was this group of or herd of caribou, and they were sliding down the hill onto the ice on the lake and then sliding across the ice. And they were lining up and taking turns doing this slide and then going back and getting behind the line and then taking turns. When it was their turn, they were sliding again. And the guy who had been watching said, "I've been watching this for 2 hours. Isn't it fascinating?" And the other story is, there was a pigeon. I was staying down in Seattle, and there used to be a small temple there in a house. And somebody was putting in a new window, so the door was open. And I was there for a couple of days with Reverend Master Zensho. We were sitting there talking, sort of in the foyer in front of the altar, when suddenly this little white pigeon walked through the door, like it owned the place, took a right turn, a right angle turn in front of the altar, and walked right up to the altar and stood there as if it was waiting. We watched this pigeon, and then Reverend Master Zensho looked at me and said, "I think that bird wants the precepts." So he went over. The bird, it was a tame, it was one of those tame pigeons, you know, that lives in a coop. It had a little band around its foot. And he allowed Reverend Zensho to pick him up, and Reverend Zensho gave him the precepts. And he put him down on the floor again, and he walked out exactly the same way he came and flew off. Another story. When we first moved up here, our cat Sima caught a mouse, and I was able to rescue the mouse before it died and shoo the cat away. But as the mouse was laying there dying, I did the funeral service for it. And it goes as follows. Take refuge in the Buddha, take refuge in the Dharma, take refuge in the Sangha. From this present body to that of becoming Buddha, you must keep these precepts well. Because of the accumulation of karma, you receive this body. Discard this karmic body quickly and enter the world of purity. Desire the pure crown of Buddhahood and realize the mind of a bodhisattva quickly. Namo Mujjini Bosatsu, Namo Kanzeyan Bosatsu. As I was saying this to the mouse, now this is something that I can only say that I experienced for myself. I knew, I could feel in my heart a connection to this being. And I knew this mouse heard me and responded to what I was saying. And then it died. And I went and told Reverend Master about it shortly after that, because I'd never experienced such a connection to another animal as I did that moment. And he said to me, "Well, don't be surprised if 20 years from now somebody knocks on your door who likes cheese and asks for the precepts. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha."